Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cancer Q&A, Understanding the Role and Reality of CAR T-Cell Therapy for Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma. And this program is co-supported by the Cancer Care Advocacy Group, particularly the Blood Cancer Patient Support Group. Our faculty today, we have Dr. Jeremy Abramson, the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, and Dr. Loretta Nostafal from the Southwest Oncology Common Spirit Mercy Hospital in Durango, Colorado. We also have four other investigators who participated in a survey where I'm going to tell you about. We really appreciate their input, and you'll see their responses in a second. This is actually a companion survey to a webinar to one we did a few weeks ago that used the same content, but that was for patients. And today we're here to talk to medical oncologists, particularly general medical oncologists. All of our programs, including the one tonight, are this is just the beginning when we actually do the program. This is the distribution way we distribute the content, both in audio podcasting, streaming platforms, and many more. So this is just the beginning tonight. We are going to focus on CAR T-cell therapy, particularly from the perspective of the community-based general medical oncologists who often don't get to see these patients as they're receiving CAR T. So we would like you to listen to a couple of people who have actually used this product about what happens clinically. As always, we will be talking about the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts for more. So what makes this a little bit different today is we're not using data slides today because we just want to query the investigators. But what we did is I met with eight different people who received CAR T therapy. They were nice enough to sit down with me for about an hour. And you're going to see very short bits of video comments from them. We showed it to the patients as well. These patients all received CAR T therapy and are in complete remission anywhere from 1 year to 8 years ago. I don't know that general oncologists get to see many people like this. I think even as important as what they say is just to look at these people and realize they were destined to go a very downhill course and now are all doing great. Here's where we're heading tonight. We're going to really focus on some general global issues about CAR T, some things that came out in our survey for patients that I think are very educational to me. But we're going to just kind of start out and give you a little look of a couple of patients and their perception about CAR T therapy. Actually, I think both of these patients are Jeremy's. And the second patient, the man, is the patient who got CAR T in 2018. That's the last therapy he got for his treatment there. Here's a couple of viewpoints on CAR T from the patients.
I like how my doctor, he said, if you're trying to explain it to someone and they're not quite understanding it, you know, with no science background and no medical background, just say, you know, we took out your T cells, which are part of your immune system. He said, tell them we made them bionic. And I thought that's a really simplistic way to get it across. And they grew them and put them back in and it killed all the cancer cells. And voila.
When I was presented with CAR T, I said, you know, let's try this because nothing else was working at that time. I didn't think I would have survived were it not for CAR T. My, you know, lymphoma was growing. Once I got the CAR T, I had no adverse reaction to the infusion itself. And you could see, boy, you know, this thing is really having a dent. The lymphoma is disappearing. And 3 months into it, it was looking like, you know, it was all clearing up. I'm, you know, so happy to be alive and recognize that, you know, life is frail. It's fleeting. These 7 years that I've had with my family, I don't know that I would have had other than for CAR T. So, you know, I'm incredibly grateful.
So you'll see a bunch of slides here today. We're not going to go through them. I just want to make you aware of them. In the chat room, you can see these slides as well as much more detail from these six investigators about what they say to their patients. You got a little bit of a glimpse of some of the things that are told to patients from these two people. But I want to start zero in on the first question. You're going to see a bunch of questions that we prepared for our faculty today. And this first question, I think, is maybe the most important one I'd like to talk about, particularly for this audience. Loretta, I'm going to start with you. And the question is, and we've been asking this question to investigators recently, and I think the answer is quite interesting. So the question is, of patients with non-Hodgkin lymphoma who investigators consider good candidates for CAR T therapy, what fraction of people like that actually end up in a CAR T therapy center for evaluation? And of those, what fraction of patients actually get the treatment? And so this kind of gets into the potential barriers to people receiving what you, I mean, what really put, for all eight of these patients, was a very, very, very important therapy. And Loretta, I'm curious for your perspective on what numbers you would give for this. You're mentioning there was an ASH paper you were working on looking at, I think, Medicare data on this. And also, maybe you can enlighten the audience a little bit about your very interesting job transfer. You were doing CAR T at MD Anderson until a year or so ago, and now you're in Durango, Colorado, seeing a very different picture of oncology. So any comments about barriers to CAR T, what numbers you would give in answer to this question, and what it's like on the other side out there in the community?
I think you're asking the most important question. Obviously, when I was at a treating center like Jeremy, we saw plenty of patients coming in the door that were equally excited as we were to have access to CAR T-cell therapy. We know that the majority of patients in the U.S. with lymphoma are actually treated in a community center. And so I grew up in a small rural area. I decided if I was going to put myself out there, I needed to take care of those patients. And so now I see a different perspective. And to answer your question, when we looked at Medicare data, when first CAR T was approved, we saw about 20% of Medicare-insured patients that were potentially eligible for CAR-T received CAR-T. We thought, well, maybe that was just the very beginning. Maybe that was just the start. There was a huge need for awareness and education. Led by Manali Kamdar, there will be an abstract at ASH this year looking at another claims data analysis, trying to get at the root of your question, who's eligible for CAR-T, who's actually getting to the center, and who's actually receiving treatment. And actually, those numbers haven't changed much. It's less than 20% of patients with relapsed refractory large cell lymphoma who should be considered for CAR T actually get to a treating center. And I think what was also shocking when we start to look at this data, the minority of them actually then undergo CAR T. Now, there are a number of reasons why that could be true, and I'm curious what Jeremy's thoughts are, but I think it highlights we need to get more patients to those centers earlier in their disease course so that we can increase those numbers of those that are potentially seen and treated with CAR.
So, Jeremy, you know, in CME, we talk about gaps between the way investigators practice and see things and people in community practice trying to take care of everything. And I cannot think of another situation in oncology where you have this incredible disparity. Can you dissect a little bit about what this is made up of, Jeremy? And particularly, of course, what we're interested in as an education group is how much of this is the doctor maybe not being aware of things, and then how much, what are the other factors? And then within the doctors, how much of this is an issue of maybe they're not aware of the benefit or how investigators see it, and how much of it is an issue of sort of thinking the bar is too high for CAR T? What's the oldest patient you've given CAR T to, Jeremy?
92, I think, is my oldest.
So, you know, and Loretta?
Upper 80s.
And yeah, I don't know the people. I wonder if there are a bunch of people in practice who are not aware of it. Anyhow, Jeremy, can you dissect out the issue?
Yeah, you know, Neil, there are just so many barriers that exist for patients to ultimately reach CAR T cell therapy. The first step is getting into the door at a CAR T cell center and initiating that whole process. And as Loretta points out, the sooner that happens, the better. Because, you know, large cell lymphoma doesn't sit on its thumbs and wait for treatment. It progresses. You know, I generally think in my own personal experience is that, you know, general medical oncologists who do the lion's share of oncology care in the United States are all, you know, these are smart, wonderful, invested physicians, and they all want the best for their patients. And while I think initially there was a knowledge gap, I think increasingly most docs are aware of CAR T cell therapy and where it belongs, particularly in the common histologies like large B cell lymphoma, and maybe some of the newer histologies like mantle cell lymphoma and where it fits in follicular lymphoma continue to be maybe a little bit of a need. But I think everybody now really appreciates that if a patient has relapsed large cell lymphoma, the best treatment for them is a CAR T cell. I don't think I don't think it's not wanting to send patients to a center. I think a lot of it is coming from the logistical barriers that prevent patients from actually getting in. The fact is patients like to be closer to home, and maybe they'll travel for a second opinion. But I think it's a very different story to say, we want you to up and travel 3, 4, 5 hours, relocate to that treating center for a month, have a family member take leave from work and stay with you. This is a big ask for patients. And there's socioeconomic issues with people taking time off from work to be caregivers during that period. And I think a lot of folks are like, well, what do you have that I can get off the shelf? Unfortunately, I don't think those options are necessarily as good as CAR T cells. So I think we do need to decrease these barriers, make it easier for patients to get in and get them home quicker from the CAR T cell center. And the FDA has recently said, you know, you really only need to keep them close to your center for a couple of weeks, where it used to be a month. And hopefully that'll help patients break down some of those barriers and getting in the door.
So another question I wanted to bring up here that I kind of really learned a lot when I saw the survey coming back, and I couldn't figure out whether things have changed or I just wasn't aware of it or whatever. But Loretta, it relates to selection of the CAR T product. And of course, we have three available. But what surprised, I always kind of had this impression that AxiCell was more effective than the other two, but it was just more toxic. But what I saw in the survey was you can tell me if I misread it, perception that actually the efficacy is very similar between the three, that it's more the preparation time. Is that the way you see that? And how do you decide which product to use? Do you go to AxiCell when you need a quicker response? Do you want to get the treatment earlier? Or how do you decide, Loretta?
Yeah, I think, as you said early on, I think there was a lot of discussion about how quick we saw responses with AxiCell, particularly in very high-risk patients, because those were the patients that this was studied in, and there was very limited bridging available just in the form of corticosteroids. I think that shaped our perception that this was a very effective treatment. Now, there were some issues in terms of CRS, particularly higher grades and ICANS. LysoCell, we had, you know, a little bit later experience. We gain knowledge as we treat these patients, so we probably got better at mitigating some of the toxicities. Intervening earlier led to lower rates of those higher grades of CRS and ICANS. There has been an indirect comparison of the data, and I hate some of those types of analyses because it's really apples to oranges, but the best we can do when we don't have a head-to-head comparison, and what we've seen in the last year is the efficacy looks to be very comparable between AxiCell and LysoCell. But as I alluded to, a little bit more favorable toxicity profile with LysoCell. So I think most are considering LysoCell for those patients that in the past you might were a little worried about tolerability of CRS and ICANS. And most are still probably considering AxiCell for those very aggressive tumors where you need that turnaround time to be short and highly successful.
So again, we're just trying to throw out questions that we think docs want to know about. And we're kind of interspersing it. It's kind of like a tasting menu. We're going to go back and forth between the videos and your comments. But let's just bring in a couple other patients who also receive CAR T therapy. And then we're going to get into sequencing of CAR T in diffuse large B cell, follicular, and mantle cell. But just a couple more comments from patients.
I had a very large tumor in my thymic area that was encroaching on my heart and both of my lungs. And I noticed really that I was sick because I am an opera singer. And I couldn't sing the phrases that I was used to singing. I needed to breathe way more. Once I got going on the actual process of CAR T, it was very exciting. I felt very privileged to do such a cool treatment. I was really, really excited about what this could mean for me. The constant question that I haven't wanted to ask because it is sort of fundamentally an incontrovertible but also kind of stupid question is, am I going to be okay? Do I get to the 5-year mark? Do I get to call myself cured? What are the rates of that?
I think it's definitely much better than chemo, you know, less, you know, evasive in many ways, less destructive in many ways too. I thought CAR T out of everything was really the least evasive, the least painful, the least terrible. I thought it was an amazing drug, an amazing thing. Apparently you can have it again. And there are also different types of CAR T. I hadn't really heard about CAR T. I was excited to try something that would be very helpful.
So we're going to, you know, take some content and distill it down into a question and just talk about it rather than show you a million slides. So, Jeremy, very simple question. Where does CAR T fit into the sequence of diffuse large B-cell? How does it vary based on risk status and clinical history? And when these patients ask their general medical oncologist, am I going to be okay? What do we know specifically about CAR T in terms of PFS and also chance for cure?
Yeah, so, you know, we initially had approval for the CAR T cell products in multiply relapsed refractory disease where they were receiving the CAR in the third line or later setting. And those studies had a median of 3 prior lines of therapy. So most of them were actually fourth line and later. And in those patients, I would estimate a cure rate of close to 40%. And of course, those patients had no opportunity for curative intent therapy otherwise. So that really dramatically changed the field. I think more recently, you know, CAR T cells have been studied as second line therapy. And today, I would argue that the vast majority of patients who relapse after frontline chemoimmunotherapy with DLBCL should get a CAR T cell. The only exception to that are the young, fit, late relapsers. If you've got a young, fit patient who relapses more than a year after frontline therapy, they're still the patient who's a candidate for high-dose therapy and stem cell transplant. But everybody else, anybody with primary refractory disease, anybody with relapse disease within 1 year, and any transplant-ineligible patient should receive CAR in second line. And we know that the CARs actually work better in second line than waiting to use it in a heavily relapsed refractory patient. And I'd estimate a cure rate of second line CAR T cells, even in these high-risk patients, of just greater than 50%.
So, Loretta, a question I'm going to ask for all three of these lymphomas is where do bispecifics fit in and what comes first? Of course, this has been out there now for a while, fortunately, bispecific or CAR T. What about in diffuse large B-cell, Loretta? In general, is CAR T going to come first? Are there situations where you would use a bispecific first? And a patient is eligible for both.
Sure. I would echo Jeremy's comments. Every patient who has relapsed large cell lymphoma, particularly not those young late relapses, which I think are becoming exceedingly rare, should be considered for CAR T first. And the reason I say that is we know that there are challenges with access. We know there are challenges with manufacturing and financial costs, which we'll probably get to. And so start that process as soon as you can. Now, we have seen some real-world data with bispecific antibodies. We have single agents approved in that third line or later space. And when we've looked at that data, they respond comparably well to what we saw with the pivotal phase 2 studies. I would argue that the real-world data with CAR T maybe even outperformed what we had seen with some of the comparable single-arm phase 2 trials. So again, big push, consider patients for CAR T as soon as you have an indication. I think bispecifics offer some advantages in that they're potentially readily available. You do have to do a dose ramp up, and so you may not get to full dose till about 3 weeks in, but it is something that you can start right away. So I've had some scenarios recently where we've had patients undergo leukapheresis, and then we start that bispecific with chemo as a bridging strategy while I'm waiting for that CAR T to be manufactured. I anticipate bispecifics are going to move into early lines, so we will need to have more information about sequencing of treatment if bispecifics are used as early as front line or if they're used early second line and then you're doing a CAR after. Again, right now, I don't think we have enough data to inform that question.
All right, let's move on to follicular lymphoma. And again, Jeremy, where does CAR T fit in? And here, the bispecific question is even more interesting. I have to say that I kind of like it, kind of creeped up on me personally. I kind of also thought for a while CAR T really, I didn't see what the role was going to be in follicular. You know, it's chronic, longstanding. We had the bispecifics. And then I started to look at the data, and the data looks good. And also, you know, it's talking about one and done too, or hopefully one and done. You know, maybe they're not going to need continuous treatment. So, Jeremy, educate us about CAR T in 2025 with follicular lymphoma.
Yeah, I tend to think CAR is underutilized in follicular lymphoma, though it is great to have multiple options and to personalize care to the patient. You know, DLBCL, we have proven curability with CAR T cells with many years of follow-up. I think most of us think follicular lymphoma is a bit different. It's an indolent disease, even in the relapse refractory setting. We don't think of these therapies as likely to be curing patients, but they can induce very durable remissions. I'd say both CAR and bispecifics have been studied in third line or later. Both induce high rates of CR and both can be durable. In general, the rates of complete response and the progression-free survival are better for a CAR T cell than for the bispecific antibodies. However, bispecific antibodies are off the shelf. They're a little bit easier, though they do require some continual dosing. And there is a concern about late infections with bispecific antibodies that get dosed for between, you know, as many, you know, as 8.5 months to, you know, or even continuously with a case of epcoritamab until progression or intolerance. So I talk to patients. If patients had a very lengthy response to frontline therapy, a very lengthy response to second-line therapy, I will often recommend a bispecific antibody for that patient. It's awfully easy. Patients with more aggressively behaving disease, they had POD24, they had a short response to second-line therapy. I much rather prefer a CAR T-cell for that high-risk patients because I know I'm going to get the deepest and most durable remission from a CAR in that setting. And I'll also note that neither one of these options negates the other in the next line of therapy. And so if a patient gets a CAR, then a bispecific will be available in the future and the other way around.
So I'm curious for your thoughts on follicular, Loretta. You know, I'm seeing there's a trial out there and they're comparing a bispecific to rituximab alone. It looks like bispecifics maybe, who knows, are going to become first-line therapy. What do we know about benefits of CAR-T after bispecifics and benefits of bispecifics after CAR-T in general? And anything you want to add to what Jeremy said about just sort of general management of the patients with FL in terms of CAR-T?
And maybe I'll start with a recent case of mine just to kind of illustrate how we've been treating follicular over the last few years and maybe where we're headed. But for the patient that I just sent to CAR-T about a month ago, 67-year-old, had frontline bendamustine rituximab, which I think is what we've been traditionally doing most commonly, had a mediocre response. He had a PFS of about 3 years, so not truly one of those early POD24 patients. Had second-line R-CHOP because when he came to me, he had quite a bit of extranodal disease. It really looked and smelled a lot like transformed lymphoma, but I get a biopsy and it's still follicular. So I give him R-CHOP second-line, and he has persistent disease at the end of treatment. Now, in the past, we may have celebrated it because he had more than a 50% reduction in the amount of disease, but he still had disease at the end of 6 cycles of R-CHOP. That, to me, is unsatisfactory. So he is getting CAR-T currently. That highlights that we've been mostly, approaching follicular lymphoma with chemoimmunotherapy. And as Jeremy alluded to, those that just sort of have that sense clinically that they're not the typical indolent behaving disease, we're going to approach those much more aggressively. I think where we're headed, though, is we're probably going to have these bispecifics enter into the front line either as monotherapy or in combination with lenalidomide. Maybe that chemotherapy just keeps getting pushed further down. We're going to start asking those important questions you're asking. How do we sequence treatment? We don't have as much data. We have some real-world data, mostly being generated by the Europeans, looking at the efficacy of bispecifics pre- and post-CAR. We have some data coming out at ASH this year looking at mosun post-CAR. And so I think we'll get more experience as this moves on. But I really don't know how we're going to be approaching follicular lymphoma in the next few years, given how effective these new treatments are.
So let's bring in mantle cell. We have Brexi-cel, which is very similar to Axi-cel. I'm not sure. Maybe, Jeremy, you can tell us what the difference is. But, Jeremy, how do you think about integrating CAR-T into mantle cell? What kind of effect do you see? Do you see cures in mantle cell? Do you use pirtobrutinib as a bridging therapy? Do you use bridging therapy in general with CAR T?
Yeah, great question. So the difference between axi-cel and brexa-cel, it's the exact same CAR T cell, but in the manufacturing of brexa-cel, there's an additional purification step to remove any potential contaminating lymphoma cells in the product. And so that difference in the manufacturing is why it's a different drug name, but it really is the identical construct. And that means it has the high rates of CRS, the high rates of neurotoxicity, and those can be particularly pronounced in mantle cell lymphoma. These patients have often circulating disease, a lot of bone marrow disease. And so I have to say the highest risk and the worst CRS and neurotox that I ever see are with brexa-cel and mantle cell lymphoma. It can be tough. Liso-cel also has higher rates than we see in large cell lymphoma, but they're still mostly lower grade. And so I do think in mantle cell, liso-cel is also a bit of a safer product compared to brexa-cel. The response rates are really great. About two-thirds of patients will achieve a complete response, and those responses can be durable. I'm not sure they're curing people. There is a continual risk of relapse, and that is on the average of 1 to 2 years. But that means that half of patients or so have a longer remission, and I've certainly have some very durable remissions in my practice, particularly folks who go in a lower tumor burden and are a bit lower risk to begin with. That gets to the issue of bridging therapy, which I think is important in mantle cell, where if you can reduce the circulating tumor burden, marrow burden, you're going to see less toxicity. And also, lower tumor burden means typically better chance of a deep and durable remission. You know, where do I use CAR in general in mantle cell? It's pretty straightforward. It's any patient with mantle cell who's been failed by a BTK inhibitor. So when I was using upfront chemotherapy and second-line BTK, it was a third-line treatment. As I increasingly incorporate BTK inhibitors into front-line therapy, patients progressing on that, I think of CAR as a second-line treatment for those patients. To cytoreduce, we do have options, but if for a patient progressing on a covalent BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib can be a very effective strategy to try and reduce the patients during the bridging period while their product is being manufactured.
So any comments on a mantle cell? You know, we're going to see some first-line data in CLL with pirtobrutinib, which you know is very well tolerated. But if you get to the point where you're going to use pirtobrutinib, Loretta, are you at the same time going to maybe send the patient for CAR T evaluation, thinking they may not be on the pirtobrutinib very long?
Yes, again, I agree entirely with Jeremy. I think one other area where mantle cell might be a little bit different is we probably have a little bit more in terms of understanding risk stratification as it pertains to like P53 mutations. And so as we move some of these targeted therapy into frontline for those high-risk patients, we're going to have to be thinking through what's our next strategy. And yes, if I have somebody who's got a P53 mutation and they're getting a frontline BTK inhibitor plus BCL2 inhibitor, I'm going to be lining up my CAR T for my next line of treatment.
And was it your observation also that when you give brexa-cel or CAR T in general, you see a lot more CRS? Is it because of circulating mantle cells, so to speak?
I generally think that's probably true. I think they also have quite a bit more extranodal involvement, and they tend to have sometimes like splenomegaly. And I think some of those sort of physical characteristics can maybe predict for higher rates of toxicity.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about cytokine release syndrome and ICANS and other neurotoxicities with a CAR T. And again, it's interesting, the man over there on the right, he actually does have mantle cell vis-a-vis in terms of what you were talking about. Incidentally, Jeremy, how do you decide between liso-cel and brexa-cel for mantle cell?
You know, I think the toxicity profile is really what sways me. I tend to prefer liso-cel over brexa-cel and mantle cell lymphoma because particularly the severity of neurotoxicity can be quite difficult in mantle cell lymphoma patients, and I find it's more manageable with liso-cel. In large cell lymphoma, Neil, there is a manufacturing time difference. So we do get brexa-cel about a week quicker than we get liso-cel. And so if it's a patient, this rapidly progressing P53 mutated patient, like Loretta's talking about, if every day counts, then that's when I reach for brexa-cel.
Got it. Okay, so let's just hear from a couple of patients in terms of their experiences.
Day two, I started spiking really high fevers. And of course, I was in the hospital, so they were able to be controlled. I really only just had one bad night for a couple of hours, but I guess I was classic textbook for the neurotox, big time. I lost 3 days. I don't even remember any of it.
When did that start about?
Day four. That evening, I kind of started with the word retrieval, but I was completely aware of it. And then the next day, it was getting a little bit worse. You know, I had it in my head. I just couldn't get it out. I guess it's probably what it's like to have a stroke and be aphasic. And then eventually, it turned into just complete nonverbal. And then it's literally like I woke up from a dream. I woke up and it was completely gone. A week after the CAR T is when it all went away.
How high were your fevers?
Like 102, 103. They never went higher than 104.
And you mentioned you had hand tremors. When did that start?
That really actually started happening after the fevers. They make you write the sentence every morning. I could see my hand coordination to my eyes were a little bit off. You know, like I would try to write and the hand wouldn't move. But I like to write very neatly. And I know it was shaking. It was all over the place.
And how long did that last?
That basically lasted, say, about a week, at the most.
So, Loretta, any comments on the granularity? This is why we'd love to get some oncologists to actually visit a center and see what actually happens to these people. And they can ask after the fact, of course. But also a question I ask a lot. We see this done in myeloma. I'm not so sure about lymphoma, preemptive tocilizumab. Is that ever used? And any comments on the spectrum of what you see with cytokine release, Loretta?
I think those cases illustrate exactly what my experience was. And I think sometimes that can be scary, both to patients and family members when they're being counseled about the potential options, because it's just so different from everything they've experienced that is very classic with chemotherapy-related toxicity. And I think the key aspects is generally fever is going to be the first thing they're going to experience. And that may be the only thing experienced. Or it may progress to those other things like low blood pressure, need for supplemental oxygen, and then the neurotoxicity can set in. But just like you heard, they usually start off with fever. If the neurotoxicity is going to set in, it's either going to set in as that fine tremor, that penmanship is going to start to deteriorate. And then you can see those patients searching for those words and getting increasingly frustrated over the fact that the brain's not working the way they expect. But in all those cases, as you heard, this reverses. And I think that's the most important thing for oncologists is, yes, these are scary toxicities. And yes, they're different from chemotherapy, but they're reversible. Now, as you mentioned, if we could prevent them altogether with things like prophylactic tocilizumab and IL-6 blocking agent, then maybe that will open the door for even more patients, or at least minimize the focus of the treatment option around the toxicity that this portrays, because I do think it is absolutely reversible and time-limited. There have been strategies looking at preemptive use of tocilizumab. We're seeing a lot of that being done in bispecifics, particularly multiple myeloma. And I've heard discussions about why do you need to have guidelines for CRS management that are disease-specific and therapy-specific when you're going to be implementing these in centers that they might treat a whole variety of things. So it would just be easier if we had one sort of comprehensive guideline. And I think if that's how you practice, you're probably going to utilize things like tocilizumab prophylaxis. You're going to utilize things like prehydration, some places even corticosteroid prophylaxis. So I think all those things are reasonable to discuss. Obviously, we'd love more data to inform how that impacts the outcomes. But anything that can mitigate some of the toxicity, I think, will help improve access to this therapy.
So, Jeremy, anything you want to add to what Loretta said about CRS? And let's also begin to get into the issue of ICANS and neurotoxicities.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely with Loretta. I think there is a concern with prophylactic tocilizumab, which is that when you block the IL-6 receptor, you actually increase IL-6 levels. And a specific study in lymphoma that looked at prophylactic use did find a lower incidence of CRS, but it actually found a higher incidence of ICANS, and that maybe by jacking up the IL-6 levels, you might worsen the ICANS, which I find is a more difficult toxicity to manage. CRS turns around very quickly if you give the tocilizumab reflexively when they develop CRS. I don't feel the strong need to prevent it, but I'd love to prevent ICANS because it's harder to treat ICANS. It's steroids and time. We have some other things we use, like anakinra if we need to. It's not clear to me that's making a huge benefit. It's really mostly steroids and time, and it can take a while to resolve. So I'm cautious about using prophylactic tocilizumab in my lymphoma patients, but I'm quick to use it if they develop it. But as I've said here, ICANS is really, you know, elegantly described in the cases that we heard earlier. It's often some word-finding difficulty, some aphasia, progressing to somnolence. If it progresses, patients can really be completely out of it. It can last 3 to 5 to 7 days and then gradually improve.
So one thing I heard in myeloma when we talked about CAR T, particularly with the agent cilta-cel, you know, you see these Parkinsonian effects. And some of these patients who, with lymphoma, you heard the man talking about a tremor in his hand. Is that considered part of ICANS, or is there some other like neurotoxicity, Loretta, that you see?
We thankfully don't see the Parkinsonian-like syndromes in the lymphoma-treated patients that they've described in the myeloma, and that may be because of the BCMA target versus CD19. But we do hear oftentimes about this sort of fine motor tremor, and that can sometimes be the first thing and the last thing that resolves in, as it pertains to neurotoxicity. That's not generally going to have a negative impact on quality of life. And so of the toxicities we see with ICANS, that's one I do prepare patients that they're likely to see, but it's unlikely to, again, be permanent and have a significant impact on quality of life. I think the part, as you heard some of the patients describe, that sort of amnesia effect where they don't remember blocks of time, that's very common. And again, family members can sometimes find that very alarming, but then they can also remind patients repeatedly about their behavior that they don't recall. And so it is an intriguing sort of toxicity that we see, particularly as it pertains to just sort of this brief but complete dysfunction of the brain that then kind of reverses just as quickly as it sets in.
I wish I had an explanation for why I forget so many things. Maybe my brain's too full of stuff. I don't know. Anyhow, let's get into some other collateral issues that I think would be interesting to talk about, particularly as it relates to finding out information, interacting with doctors, but also clinical research.
I'm somewhat privileged. My wife had done a great deal of research. Had I been the sole information gatherer, I probably could have done maybe 10% of it. Just because of my condition, but also my inability to kind of think broadly and see things broadly. I think a patient needs to have a patient advocate. They need an individual that goes to bat for them, no holds bar. And I believe that to be true, even if you have the greatest doctor in mind that's helping you, I think you need that patient advocate that's really asking those key questions that I certainly wouldn't be able to as a patient.
I'm curious if you have any questions or think you'd like to hear them discuss about clinical research in this area.
Most definitely, and here's why. It's very simple. It's four letters, H-O-P-E. I would just say that hope is information from your doctors that allows you to function while you're going through all this stress and anxiety and worrying about stuff. I literally asked my transplant doctor, I said, what do you do if this doesn't work? And he goes, well, we're not going to give up. We'll try something else. And that meant a lot to me, I can tell you right there. You got people on your team.
So, Loretta, I saw you shaking your head a lot as the first patient was talking about finding an advocate. Anything you want to say about what you just heard? And then I want to sort of glide into this next question. We brought up the issue of clinical research and participating in trials. What's going on right now? What do we know about mechanisms of resistance to CAR T? What are some of the new trial avenues, new types of CAR T that are being looked at? What are some of the trials that are available right now? Any general thoughts, Loretta?
Yeah, I think in general, I think the first patient illustrates very nicely. When you're really sick from a disease like large cell lymphoma, maybe even mantle cell, where the disease is growing so quickly, it's really hard to kind of wrap your brain around the complex discussions that we often dump on patients and their family members to help us navigate this incredibly challenging treatment landscape. And so I do think having people in the room that listen to what you say, recording that discussion, going to services like you provide, Neil, that provide information and in multiple different formats so that you can process all of it that's coming in at you. Clearly, I'm a huge advocate for clinical trials for multiple reasons. We want to help patients, and the best way to help patients is to study that next great thing. But the part that we often don't realize the impact is we can also educate our ancillary staff, our nurses in the clinic, our infusion nurses, our inpatient teams. And oftentimes on trials, that's where they get their first exposure to some of these novel therapies, where they have a playbook, that protocol that helps walk them through what to expect and how to potentially react to it. And so I think our society benefits from everyone having access to clinical trials. We need to do a better job of getting them into places like smaller communities that aren't affiliated necessarily with large academic centers where we can propagate that information. There are a number of initiatives that are underway because we did great with the first CAR-Ts, but that was the first wave of this. Just like we have multiple waves of BTK inhibitors, there's going to be the next wave. And so can we minimize some of the resistance mechanisms through dual antigen targeting, utilizing healthy T cells from donors and allogeneic CAR-T? Can we shorten the manufacturing? And can we eliminate the manufacturing altogether, even if we're not doing an allo CAR? So those are the next waves of research that are currently being investigated.
Jeremy, anything you want to add to that? And when you see a patient with disease relapse after CAR-T, and of course, maybe it's going to be different for, depending on the type of lymphoma, how often is this because the cells are no longer present? Or is there some kind of like resistance biologically that you see in other types of, you know, targeted therapy, et cetera, that causes the clinical resistance?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there are a lot of different mechanisms of resistance we're learning with CAR T cells, but about maybe probably no more than a quarter or so of patients are resistant because they lose the target antigen. That's more common in acute lymphoblastic leukemia, but most patients who relapse still have CD19 on their cell surface. And it's also not from just loss of the CAR T cell. The majority of patients who relapse still have detectable CAR T cells in circulation. So if they've got CARs in circulation and they've got CD19 on the surface, then what the heck is going on? And what it appears to be happening is there is immune evasion, that T cells, these CAR T cells can get exhausted and they lose their ability to kill the cancer cells. And so a number of the mechanisms of new products are now seeking to overcome the development of CAR T cell exhaustion to maintain that immune attack. And some of that is just a better manufacturing and a quicker manufacturing where you produce a less exhaustible, more of a stem memory phenotype CAR T cell that targets the tumor cell and doesn't become exhausted as quickly. We are looking at a number of dual targeted CARs to prevent antigen loss, even because that is still a mechanism in probably about a quarter of patients. And I think there's also a number of strategies that are possible to think about combinations with CARs and other therapeutics to, again, help maintain the immune strength of the CAR against the lymphoma cell.
Okay, we'll bring a couple of patients back again and bringing up a couple other important issues. One, financial issues, also long-term issues that really relate, particularly when a patient comes back to the general oncologist. I have to ask you, though, Jeremy, this man who got Lysocell in 2018, like, what were you thinking? Obviously, it was on a trial, but like, what were you thinking at that 2018 about CAR-T?
Well, you know, it was still pretty new back then, and that was in the setting of a clinical trial because we didn't have an approved CAR T cell back then. This gentleman had primary refractory primary mediastinal large cell lymphoma that wasn't responding to either front or second line therapy. And Loretta and I both remember the days that if you had a primary refractory mediastinal large cell that wasn't responding to second line, we sort of had this wrenching knot in our stomach that it wasn't going to respond to anything else. These primary refractory cases have historically been the toughest. So we really didn't have any good options for this patient other than CAR, which it was new, it was exciting. We were seeing some home run responses in patients who we knew would not respond to other things. And this gentleman is a great example of that. And 7 years later, he's in an ongoing remission and cured.
I think every oncologist dreams of the day that this is what oncology is going to be like in general, you know, maybe even a lot less toxicity, but with these kind of results. Anyhow, here are the patients.
Somebody should talk about, you know, does insurance cover it or not cover it, right? Is it, you know, Medicare cover it, not cover it? Is it covered by, you know, private insurance? What happens if, you know, you get some neurological impairment? You know, does that get covered? At my stage, there were very few centers that were doing this. I think, you know, there's more now. But particularly, you know, in rural, semi-rural areas or, you know, away from a center, I have to travel. I have to come 300 miles to go to, you know, Birmingham, Alabama. And will I have a place to stay, you know, if I have to be admitted? Is this done outpatient, inpatient? How are those costs, you know, handled?
How long does it take for my body to be normal? In what ways is my body never going to be normal? What can I expect? And especially as it relates to putting me at risk for other things, and specifically infection.
So Loretta, Durango, Colorado, a lot different than Houston, Texas. I'm kind of curious what you were thinking about when the gentleman was talking about the financial issues and what you see out there in Durango in terms of the challenges to actually get CAR-T done and the financial obstacles.
I think he hit on all the key factors. We're 6 hours from the nearest treating center, but that's around a mountain range. And so when I start talking about this, patients say, well, I will consider that, but not in the winter months. I will consider that if I have a caregiver that can go with me. I think we also minimize the fact that all of these patients generally have been giving up probably 6 to 9 months of their life because they just went through either induction therapy that's pretty intense, generally given every 3 weeks, a lot of toxicity, a lot of management of that. Caregivers are oftentimes also putting their lives on hold just to get them through that. Now we're talking about a process that's going to require them to travel to a center. There's going to be probably at least 3 trips for that first initial consultation, second trip for the leukapheresis, the third trip that they're going to have to then stay for an extended period of time. I think Jeremy hit on all these aspects earlier. And so why put people through that headache? It's because we have a lot of confidence that that might be their last treatment. We don't have enough treatment centers in the U.S., and a lot of them are still aggregated close proximity to each other. If you look at a map of all the CAR-T centers, it's not equally distributed across the U.S. And so I'm in an area that's kind of a treatment desert. And so I do think we should be talking about how can we get these therapies to patients, but it has to be done safely. And then we don't talk about the financial cost to the centers as much as we probably should as well, because these therapies are costly, but building the infrastructure to deliver the therapy requires some investment. And lymphomas are rare. If you're talking to an oncologist, they may see one of these cases a year. Is that really going to be a worthwhile investment from that institution? So these are the challenges we face.
Jeremy, anything you would add to that? And also, can you talk a little bit about post-CAR-T management in the community, particularly the issue of infections, prophylactic antimicrobials, vaccinations, IVIG? What are some of the issues that come up?
Yeah, I agree with everything Loretta said. You know, I think one thing that we've learned, we've talked so much about CRS and ICANS and the cytopenias immediately following treatment, that it's easy to overlook the long-term side effects. And I think we're seeing a light shown on that now, which is a wonderful thing. We have all these survivors that are now out, you know, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 5 years, 7 years, a decade. And what we do see is that the number one cause of non-relapse mortality is infections, we do batter the immune system. Oftentimes, these patients have had multiple types of chemotherapy even before CAR T-cells, so they go into CAR with a battered immune system. Then we give them lymphodepleting chemotherapy, and then the process itself with CAR further immune suppresses. And so patients are often T-cell depleted. Their CD4 counts can be quite low and stay low for a very long time. They can be hypogammaglobulinemic, often in a sustained manner. The neutropenia typically is resolving within the first 30 days, and if not by 30 days, 60 days. But after that happens, we need to be checking immunoglobulin levels. If patients have low IgG levels and they're getting severe or recurrent infections, they should go on IVIG replacement. For patients, I keep my patients on antiviral and pneumocystis prophylaxis until I prove that their CD4 count has rebounded over 200, because we can see that sometimes they never will. Sometimes these folks remain low forever, and I've seen very late cases of pneumocystis before we did laboratory-guided discontinuation. And then the other thing to be aware of are vaccines. The most common infections are actually respiratory viral infections. Making sure people are vaccinated against influenza, COVID-19, RSV, making sure they're up to date on pneumonia vaccines. These are all essential. And the other is that there's a low risk of opportunistic infections. I mentioned pneumocystis, but thinking if a patient has a fever, checking things like CMV for a CMV reactivation and others, because these folks are at risk for a host of these complications, which is why it's so important for the treating center and the primary oncology center who cares for these patients long-term to really be collaborating in the care of these patients and educated on what to check and when to give prophylactic or IVIG-type interventions.
So, Loretta, anything you want to add to this issue of sort of long-term follow-up in terms of the kind of issues that come up that Jeremy talked about? Also, any complementary strategies that theoretically could not only make people feel better, but even improve the therapy. I have to share with you, I don't know if you spent a lot of time with your pulmonary colleague at MD Anderson, John Haymock. You know John?
Oh, yes, very well.
I spent a couple hours with him a couple weeks ago, Jeremy. He had his paper at AACR where they showed, now this is about another kind of immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors, but they showed that people who got COVID vaccine had twice the response rate to immunotherapy, you know, probably some kind of stimulation. Any thoughts about any lifestyle or anything else that could augment, any advice you give to patients, diet, exercise, anything, Loretta, that you think maybe in general might be better, maybe would boost their immune system?
I think you highlighted an important topic. We're kind of following the lessons learned with checkpoint inhibitors and other immune therapies and solid tumors where they have much larger number of patients at a larger number of studies. The microbiome is probably critically important, and those studies are underway. We just fall a little short of knowing exactly what the prescription should be, which probiotic, when to utilize it. Obviously, avoiding unnecessary antibiotics, I think, are important. Exercise, I think, is critically important. As you heard one of the patients, she wanted to know when was she going to get back to normal and what was normal going to feel like. So I think you need exercise to help facilitate that. We're putting together a group of treating centers and some community oncologists now that the REMS program has been eliminated, and we anticipate patients are going to be returning back to their originating sites sooner. Maybe that will eliminate some of the barriers. But then there's a need for education, like Jeremy alluded to. What vaccines and when do you give them? What infections do you need to be mindful of? Do you need to give G-CSF prophylaxis and timing of that? These are all things that treating centers have mastered because they've had years of experience of refining their protocols. But now we're putting this on the community oncologists and expecting them to have that years of knowledge built up. And so we need those guidelines. We need that sort of fostering a relationship between the treating center and the community oncologist so that we can continue to provide that knowledge so that patients can get back to normal lives sooner.
Jeremy, any other complementary strategies, massage, acupuncture, also any alternative medicines, I forget the name of some of the more common ones that you're concerned about patients taking that might interfere with their treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know,
Ivermectin. Ivermectin.
Ivermectin, I would avoid that unless there's a bona fide indication for it. But I love your pitch for vaccinations. Patients should get vaccinated. I think the most important thing is exercise. We know that's true in CAR T cells. We know it's true across oncology. Patients who maintain their conditioning do better long term. I think, you know, this is something that is personalized to the patient. Whatever health patients sort of, you know, approach their wellness in a lot of different ways. I encourage them to find what works for them. Sometimes it's yoga and meditation. Sometimes it's massage. Sometimes it's acupuncture. For things like deep massage and acupuncture, you want to make sure the platelets are good and you're not going to risk for bleeding. In terms of supplements, some things like high-dose vitamin E and ginkgo can increase the risk of bleeding. Those are things I try to avoid. But in general, I say, what helps promote wellness for you? And it can be very personalized. And I think it's important to talk to patients about what works for them and how to incorporate that safely into their care, because I think all of this together can help foster the best outcomes.
So this last video, actually, I saw three of the patients sort of responded to the question of what works for them, including does working work for them? So here are three patients. I'll be curious what Loretta thinks.
I'm a meditator. I do yoga. I do Tai Chi. They were so fundamental to my ability to, A, go through the treatment, to understand what was happening to my body. So I think, you know, very, very important, Dr. Love.
When I come up against that six-month visit to Johns Hopkins, I'll be honest, I get nervous again. I don't want to say I live waiting for the shoe to drop, but I just get nervous until there's anxiousness till I get the results.
Anything that you found over time that helps you with the nervousness?
I'm Christian, so I really have relied on my faith.
Would you like to give us a sample of your singing?
Sure.
Go for it.
Let's see.
Que si tu blanches tour terrelle de serrer de vautour.
Loretta, any thoughts?
I mean, that's why we do this job, right? People are so fascinating and they have so much to share with each of us. I do think there is some scan anxiety. I mean, they just face something that's really potentially going to end their life. And now every time they're looking to us to give them that reassurance that everything's going to be okay, that they can now start thinking beyond 3-month increments. And so, everybody's going to be a little bit different, but find that community, find that thing that gives you hope and inspiration. We do a lot of art in my house. I have a child that has pretty severe anxiety. So I also tell my patients, if you can do 20 minutes of some form of journaling or artistic expression every day, we know that lowers cortisols, and I've seen that firsthand be an effective strategy. But again, just find your inner strength is generally what we're trying to find.
So one final question, I'll come back to Jeremy. This came from the chat room. Jeremy and Danielle wants to know whether you think there are differences in institutions and how effective they are in actually utilizing CAR-T. Do you think some are more effective than others? And also, how do you decide when to, quote, send the patient back to the community? And do you continue to interact with the community once they, quote, go back?
Yeah, great question. You know, in general, institutions today that are giving CAR T cells are very experienced centers in cellular therapy. These are usually centers that have been doing highly specialized cancer therapies already, including stem cell transplants. And so I'm generally confident in all of these centers that are administering CAR T cells. It's only about 200 centers across the country. And I think our focus needs to be on training up more centers in order to be able to get this treatment closer to home. In terms of the second question, Neil, remind me what that was.
The interface between the center and the community, when do they go back, so to speak?
Yeah, so we're usually sending folks back about a month later. We typically take them through the immediate toxicity period, get a scan at around day 30 to make sure the disease has responded, and then have patients go home. But we generally work out an arrangement with the patient's primary oncologist of how often we're going to be seeing the patient. Maybe it's once every 3 to 6 months, where they're going to get their imaging, who's going to be checking their blood counts, who's going to be checking their immunoglobulins, who's going to be administering IVIG. It's important to really formally lay out that collaborative plan so that patients don't get kind of fallen between the cracks.
Final comment from Loretta about, again, this interaction between tertiary centers and the community.
I think for this to be successful, we have to have an open dialogue. We have to have open conversation. As Jeremy said, most, if you can relieve that anxiety of what the expectations are, I think that will help. I think primary doctors are also nervous they're not going to get those patients back. And having been on the treating center, I couldn't get them back fast enough because patients are beating on the door to get back to their regular life. So I think there are some misperceptions out there, but we're all in it together and we want to get these patients back to their regular lives.
So grateful to you, Loretta and Jeremy, for working with us tonight. Particularly grateful to the 8 patients who sat down with me for this program and also for the patient program. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Loretta. Thanks, Jeremy. Have a great one.
Thank you.
Thank you.